Thank you for listening to this message from the pulpit of Coon Rapids Baptist Church in the suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Job chapter 3 in our Bibles, and the title of the message tonight is Good Grief. Mr. Davids has been a railroad engineer or conductor, I guess, I'm not sure exactly which one of those, working in freight for 39 years. In those years, Mr. Davids has been involved in 16 railroad crossing accidents. One wintry day near Christmas in Utah, when he'd only been on the job for about a year, as he came down, of course, in the engine there of the train, moving rather quickly through an area, he could see on the tracks in the distance a car was stuck on the tracks. He could see that a lady was clamoring as quickly as possible to try to get out before the train got there. And he was in his cab when he realized that she didn't make it out in time. He saw it all from the cab of the engine. For him, the problem is that those things like that and the other 15 incidents are in his mind in vivid detail. For some conductors, the accidents are so horrible that they have to take extended leave. They have depression. They have PTSD. And some of them leave the industry entirely. The conductor is sitting in his cab of his locomotive, of his engine there, doing everything he can to stop that train. But of course, you know, it takes a mile for that to happen. Once the train finally does stop, he's able to report the incident and immediately hoofs it back to try to get back to the scene and see if he can do anything to help. And most of the time, there's nothing that they can do to help in the situation. Until the 1970s, the conductor and his crew were expected to help clean up after the accident and then return back to work and take the train on down the tracks. Now laws have changed and they are required to be replaced by a new crew. 90% of the time when the media come to cover such an accident, they never mention whether or not the train crew is okay. As a result of these accidents, grown men sit there and just sob. Sometimes there are lawsuits that go on for several years, and as they are a part of this, every so often they must go to court and relive all of the horrific events of that over and over again. Sometimes they are continually called in their job to pass the exact same location with that little marker off to the side where that incident happened. Over and over. They remember the anniversaries of those things, and sometimes men will come up with all sorts of reasons not to go to work on those particular days. Sometimes in the future, for various reasons, they find out more and more details that only make the accident worse. Mr. David said one time he found out that the lady who had been killed had a little girl and was planning to be married the very next week. Years later, he was going to speak to a teen driving class, driver's ed, and speak about the importance of being careful when it was crossing the railroad tracks. And when he got all said and done, that same girl, now a teenager, was in that class, came up and talked to him and said, "I don't remember my mother at all, and I was raised by my grandparents." What incredible suffering we don't think about these engineers and these conductors in these trains go through. When through, most of the time, no fault of their own, they are a part of a horrific, life-ending accident. It's incredible suffering that many of them struggle with. How do we grieve when we face unthinkable suffering? The horror might be so awful that we would respond in ways that we would have never seen coming. We might have feelings that we would have never imagined we would ever have in our minds, in our bodies, in our lives here. And so as we process suffering and as we go through this ache, what is good grief? The story of Job tells us in chapters 1 and 2 that Job experienced unthinkable suffering. God deliberately attacked Satan, attacking his enemy, and used the righteous Job. God used righteous Job in this situation But it resulted in Job experiencing horrible suffering. In a moment of time, Job lost his entire fortune. In a moment of time, all 10 of his kids were gone. In a moment of time, all of his servants lost their lives. A short time later, his health was completely broken. His wife seemed to be against him. Any sense of dignity or respect that he had in the community was gone as he was kicked out of town, living on the garbage heap there, scraping the pus from his sores that covered his body from his head to his heels. His friends, even when they came to see him, we can tell by their response to him that they said nothing for a week, that they cried out in agony when they first saw him and didn't even recognize him. We can tell from their response that Job's suffering was unfathomable, unbelievable, mind-boggling suffering here. Most of all, as we'll see later on, the sweet relationship which this godly man Job enjoyed with God felt like it was gone. That God was silent at this time, cold and distant. And for 7 long days, Job sat there and thought about all of this. Do you know what that's like to sit there and just think and think and think about it more? For 7 long days, he said nothing about this. As the pain in him continued to warm and to boil and to swell there. With everything else gone, he had nothing else to do but to sit there and ache, think, and suffer for a whole week. And finally, Job chapter 3, Job speaks. And when he does, he expresses his grief in shocking tones. All humans are going to suffer. There's a curse that brings suffering. There can be persecution that can bring suffering. There can be personal sins. There can be sins of others against us. All human beings are going to suffer. And when we suffer, it produces in us grief. We should expect that we are going to grieve. There's going to be times when we're going to hurt. We're going to struggle here with that grief. How do we respond? And this chapter that we have of 26 verses in front of us does a couple things for us. There's a couple benefits of looking at Job chapter 3. One of them is this: it gives us permission to grieve appropriately. This chapter, in looking at this, looks at a godly man and how he grieves. And it gives us permission that when we suffer, we can grieve appropriately as well. And the second thing it really helps us to do is there are going to be times in which others around us are going to be grieving, and we're not going to know what to do, what to say. We're not going to know how to interpret the things that they're going through. It helps us as counselors, as comforters, as friends and families members to understand a little bit of what they're going through, to understand a little bit of what might be going on in their mind as they express their grief in these different ways. We can see it and we can grasp it better. Because Job's friends, they misread some of his expressions of grief and caused a lot of problems in the chapters that we'll study in the future, chapters 4 and following. And so the truth I want to challenge you with tonight is this: in the face of unthinkable suffering, you must have good grief. Let's pray. Father, I do thank you for this chapter. I pray that you help us to understand the chapter and apply it to our lives. And Lord, in these times when we are grieving or others around us are grieving, we pray that the truths of your word would help us to go through those situations. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. What I want to do tonight is to walk through the chapter and have some understanding of it. And then I'm going to make some applications of the chapter and we'll be done here tonight. There's a lot of truth that's here that I want to give to you. And so I'm going to try to just jump right in and go with it. Job, in this chapter, as he expresses his grief, he does it in 3 different waves. And I want you to see these different waves. The first one is this. First, Job cursed the day of his birth. All right, that would be a point number 1, in a sense. Job cursed the day of his birth. Now, you'll remember that God and Satan were talking, and Satan was saying that he would curse God. Job's a righteous person. He loses everything, his health, and so much more that we've talked about here. And he doesn't get mad at God. He doesn't curse God. Instead, he curses the day of his birth. And it's brought out here, chapter 3, verse 1. After this, opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. like his birthday. Verse 2, and Job spake and said, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived. And what Job does here in these verses, this is from verse 1 down through verse number 10 here, as Job discusses this in this section here, Job connects the ideas in his poem here that he's saying, the idea of his birth, the day of his birth, and the night of his conception. Another subject for another time. It's interesting how he parallels conception and birth. It would be interesting to study that out in regards to pro-life matters here. But Job here curses the day of his birth, curses the night of his conception. He wishes he were never born, as it were. He wishes he had never been conceived. And he talks in the first several verses about wishing that the day of his birth would have been just covered in darkness forever. Look at these verses with me. Verse 4. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the night shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. Over and over and over, he's talking about let darkness come upon it. Let darkness come upon it. In a sense, what he's saying is, I wish my birthday had never seen the light of day. Is what he's saying. When God created the world, he said, let there be light. And Job's expressions here are almost that he could wish that day were uncreated. That day, let it be darkness. I just wish my birthday never existed at all. That's what he's saying. Then he shifts on in poetic words and he talks about the night of his conception here. Verse 6, as for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. As he describes it here, he says, I wish that the night that I was conceived just never existed. I wish that I was conceived on February the 31st. A night that doesn't exist. Because if that would have happened, I wouldn't exist. And I wouldn't be going through all this pain and this agony right now. In verse number 7, he says, lo, let that night be solitary. In other words, let it not produce anything. Let it be alone. Let no joyful voice come therein. No happiness between mom and dad on that night. Verse 8, let them curse it that curse the day who are ready to raise up their mourning. Here he kind of goes in an interesting realm and uses some things that in some of the cultures people talk about. Those that curse the day would be like professional cursers. People that was their job to professionally curse something. And he's wishing in a sense, all right, he's not endorsing it, but he's just expressing his pain here. He says, I wish that these people who are professional cursers could just curse the day, the night where I was conceived, the day that I was born. The expression, who are ready to raise up their mourning. The word mourning is an interesting word to study out, and we could spend a lot of time talking about it. It's actually the word for Leviathan. Leviathan is used a lot of times throughout the rest of the book of Job, and Leviathan is this sea serpent, the sea monster. And in some of the different cultures, not that it was biblical teaching, Job was just using everyday illustrations here. In some of the cultures, they thought that the sea monster was the one that would come up out of the ocean and would swallow the sun or the moon, and that's how you had an eclipse. That was kind of their way of describing it here. And so what he's saying is, I wish that they could, these cursers, could call up this Leviathan and he could swallow the moon on the night that I was conceived, and therefore that night never existed. Again, he's not endorsing all of this myth. That's not what really happens next time you see an eclipse. All right? But he's just using that to try to bring out the idea a little bit here. Verse number 9, let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day. Again, he's talking about that night. Let it be blacked out. Never let it see the light of day here. Why? Because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. The word sorrow is the word he's going to use later on in verse 20 for misery. It's the idea of all the hard work and sweat when you put into a job and it's just miserable toil here. He says, I just wish that the day that I was born, I just wish that the night that I was conceived never even existed. Pretty amazing thing, isn't it, to be able to say something like that? Just wishes he never would have existed. But then he shifts into the second section of the chapter here. And as he shifts into this second section, it's like, well, okay, so it happened. So I was conceived, so I was born. But you know what? If I can't have my first wish that I just wish I never would have come into existence, my second wish would be this. I just wish that the day I was born, I would have died. I just wish I would have died the very day I was born. Or I wish I would have been born dead. Stillborn. And that's what he says in verses 11 down through verse number 19. That's the second section. Job wished he had died at birth. Look at verse number 11. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me, or why the breasts that I should suck? He's asking these questions as to why didn't I die as soon as I was born? Why did my mother feed me here? And here he tells the reason why, verse 13, for now should I have lain still and been quiet. I should have slept. Then had I been at rest. And Job is saying, you know what, my life is so full of turmoil right now. If I would have just died, I would have been at rest. Instead of going through all this turmoil, all this frustration, all this stress that I'm experiencing here. Notice his companions. If he would have died then, notice who he would have been with. Verse 14, with kings and counselors of the earth, which built desolate places for themselves. Or with princes that had gold, who filled their houses with silver. He says, you know, if I just would have died, I would be with all sorts of other people, you know. Great kings, they die, and princes die, and wise counselors die. I would have been with them. They would have been my buddies. They would have been my companions here. So he says, I just wish I would have died as soon as I was born. Or he gives in verse 16 through 19, the second half of that, I just wish I would have been stillborn. Verse 16 says, or as in hidden, untimely birth, I had not been, as infants which never saw light. In some of the cultures, a stillborn child was viewed as being possessed of spirits. And so they would take them out and hide the body as they buried it, hiding it. And he says, I just wish I would have been one of those infants that they bury and hide that way. As he uses familiar things in some of that culture and some of that way. He says in verse 17, again, notice his companions. He says, there the wicked cease from troubling. All the troubles that they've brought upon themselves and all the troubles that they experience here, that would be over. There the weary be at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor. The small and the great are there, and the servant is free from his master. And Job looks at these people here and Job says, these would be my companions here. Someone described this list as the people that are happier dead than alive. Wicked and weary and prisoners, small and great and servants. Happier dead than alive. And Job just wishes he had died at birth. Pretty incredible grief. But his grief continues in the third and the final segment of this chapter here. He first of all wishes, he says, I just wish I never would have been born, but it happened. I just wish I would have died on the very day I was born, but that happened. So his third wish in the rest of the chapter is that he would die soon. I just wish I could die any time now would be good. Verse number 20, wherefore or why? Why is light given to him that is in misery? And life unto the bitter in soul, which long for death, but it cometh not, and dig for it more than for hid treasures, which rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid and whom God hath hedged in? And Job is asking this question here. Why? Why life? Why light? Synonyms there. Light refers to life here. And why does God give light to somebody who is miserable? They're going through the sorrows and the agonies here. Why does God give light to someone that's in bitterness of soul, he describes here? We'll talk about bitterness more later here. He says these people long for death, and he gives a word picture. He says it's like somebody who is digging for buried treasure. And that was a common thing in those cultures. They didn't have banks quite like we did, and people buried treasures. And so when they thought that they could find it, even modern archaeologists have told stories about finally when someone's on they think that right now they've found it, if they'll just dig a little bit farther, they will dig until they just wear themselves out in exhaustion because they're sure that treasure is right there. They'll dig and dig and dig. And he says, you know what? It's like we're digging, 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 just trying to dig ourselves into our own cemetery plot, trying to dig ourselves into our own grave. Our own coffin. They want to die. Why does God give people life when they want to die? They rejoice exceedingly and are glad, verse 22, when they find the grave finally. He says in verse 23 that his way is hid and his God has hedged this in. That's a very interesting expression. Job's way is hidden. His way is his path of life. And he has no idea why all of these things have come upon him. God has hidden the road of his life and not told him why all of a sudden all these problems are coming. His way is hedged in. You know, this hedge is an interesting thing. We think of this set of bushes here that were around the ways and the roads here. That in chapter 1 in verse number 10 is exactly what Satan said. Oh, the reason that Job serves you is because you, God, have hedged him in. You put a fence around him to protect him so I can't get in him. And that's why he serves you, is because you put a hedge around him. It's interesting, kind of a little bit of irony, a little bit of play on words here, that now Job says, I feel like I'm hedged in and I can't get out. I'm stuck here. And you know what? If you think about it, Job was stuck. What did he have left that he could do? Everything was gone. He's a man of character. He can't curse God, but he can't die either. He's absolutely stuck and hedged in. God, why do you give me life when you don't show me the future? You don't show me my way. It's hidden, and you've hedged me in. You've fenced me in, so I can't go anywhere else here. This is the expression that he has. In the last few verses, the last three verses here, he gives the reason for his lament. It kind of started out as a curse, as we read in verse number 1. In verse number 11, it shifts over to more of a lament style. And he gives the reason. He says, for my sighing cometh before I eat. Like every time he sat down to a meal, he's just sighing and grieving before or in place of even eating. He says, my roarings are poured out like water. His roarings, his groanings, his pains just rush out of him. They just pour out and roaring waters there. They're just loud and full. He says, verse 25, by the way, have you ever experienced 25? For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. He said, my worst nightmares came true. I wondered if something like this would happen. My worst nightmares came true. In verse 26, he says, I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. Job indicates in that last verse, you know, I'm not at rest, I'm not quiet, and yet trouble keeps pounding me and pounding me and pounding me and pounding me. You think about what it'd be like if you were Job. And one day you were in your office and the first servant came in and told you all this was gone. And the next servant and the next servant and the next servant. And you go by, I don't know, a couple days, whatever. And then all of a sudden, boom, you wake up one day and you're all of a sudden covered in boils. Just boom, 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 boom. As you go down through all of this, would you kind of the next morning walk out thinking, what's going to hit me next? What's left? Am I going to lose an arm? I mean, you're just not going to know. And Job is like, the trouble just keeps pounding me and pounding me and pounding me. This is the grief that Job has experienced, and this is what he has said to his friends as he has opened his mouth. It's a poem. It's an interesting thing about his poem, just a little word about poetry here before I make some applications. His poem, he repeats himself several times. You know, back when he talked about the day of his birth, he said it's darkness and darkness and darkness and darkness. Because he's driving home a point there. And sometimes he'll say it three times, like here at the end, I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble comes. And he's talking about the idea, or the way it's written there, is the idea that it's progressive. Three sets, and then boom, the big point at the end. The whole way that he even writes the poetry is climactic, it's big, it's telling how huge his grief was. One Bible student called this the most depressing chapter of the Bible. It's an interesting thing to consider. So what can we learn from this chapter? One Bible student asked the question, was Job's response in grief a good example or was it a bad example? And then he went on to answer his own question, and he said this, it's just a real example. This is how people grieve. It's a realistic example of someone grieving so that Christians today can know what grief looks like. And yet I would submit to you that Job, being a godly man, responding in the right way, I would suggest that this is an example of good grief. Now, in the remaining amount of time that I have, I want to mention to you several different things that we can learn about grief from this chapter. I'm going to give you six. Three of them we're going to spend time on. Three of them I'm just going to mention in passing. And I hope that they'll be a help to you. Let me give you these truths about grief. Number one, those grieving might be vocal, loud, and passionate. Those grieving might be vocal, loud, and passionate. When you read and study out Job chapter 3, a lot of Bible students are just shocked that Job responds this way. I mean, in Job chapter number 2, Job is like this perfect hero. I mean, Job loses everything. Boom, 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 boom. And Job just gets down on his face and he says, God, you took it all away. Or you gave it all to me. You get it. You took it all away. You're wonderful. And you're just like, wow, who is this guy? And then boom, a short time later, he loses all of his health and he has other pressures upon his life. And yet Job is still not cursing God. And you're looking at Job and you're like, man, what a guy, what a hero here. What an incredible example. I can't believe how he's responding. And then the very next chapter, you read about Job just pouring out his grief here in some incredible ways here. And it's a little bit shocking here. You read about Job cursing something. You read about Job saying he wishes he were dead. You read about Job throwing out the question why over and over. You read about him saying, God, you got me hedged in. You got me boxed in and I can't get out here. You read about Job sighing and groaning and roaring here, there. It's incredible language here. Job is experiencing all these things. Some people, as they study it, come just short of saying that Job is cursing God here. He's not cursing God, though. If he had cursed God, the whole thing would be over. But Job is pouring out his grief. He's bold. He's in pain. He's in horrible pain. And he curses the day of his birth. Some Bible students, as they look at this, say, obviously, it's impossible to curse the day of your birth. It doesn't accomplish anything. And so Job, not hoping to accomplish anything, is really, by doing so, really just pouring out his grief. He's showing us how bad he's hurting, how bad he is grieving at this time. It's a cry from his heart. It's an upsurge of his emotion. And truly, Job's curse was a loud cry of the heart, expressing deep pain. Why should not Job or others who are suffering express their griefs to God? God knows your griefs already, and He knows the depths of the griefs that you bear here. Job's cries are so loud that his friends are shocked about them here. But Job's cries are an expression of his strong grief. We talked about the word bitter in verse number 20 here. Life unto the bitter in soul. Bitterness is not a silent bitterness. Have you known somebody that's bitter? Bitter people can sometimes be the loudest, caustic, argumentative, upset types of folks. There is an expression of that when there's a bitterness upon someone's soul, and Job is expressing it. Those grieving sometimes will grieve loudly, vocally, passionately. Puritanism may have convinced many in the church today that a stiff upper lip and a stoic stance are the only allowed expressions of grief. And Job's grief gives people permission to cry and to cry loudly. Not that we're crying loudly and screaming in anger at God or anybody else, but crying out of our heart because of the incredible pain that we have. That we can be vocal and not sin as we express our grief. Kenneth Haug puts together a series of booklets for those that are grieving, and one interesting thing that he said I found connected here well. He says that for many people, as they grieve, they have found it very therapeutic to scream. Some of them in a shower, some of them in a pillow, in a car, in a parking lot near an airport as planes take off or land. But releasing that pent-up emotional energy for some of them. I'm not advocating it one way or the other. I'm simply acknowledging this. That many times when we grieve loudly because we're in such pain. The second truth that we see from Job chapter 3 is that those grieving might wish for death. You can't miss the fact that Job wished for death. He talks about it. I mean, it's the whole point of the chapter in three different ways. Job's particular situation made death seem to be the only way of escape. If he could just die, he could get out of this problem here. And he mentions it these three different times. Job's speech of grief tells us that there are times of suffering in which the grief is so bad that a person could wish that they had never been born. That they could possibly suffer so badly that they could wish that they had died the moment they had born. Or that they could wish that they would die any time now that they wish it. That someone could suffer so badly that they would take all of the joys of their life, all of the blessings, all of the experiences, all of the good things that God has given to us, like God had given to Job, and they would be willing, because of the suffering that they are experiencing, to trade all of those good things just to get rid of the pain and the grief that they're going through. That is suffering. That is grief. Job here expresses this, and one of the things that he says here that we talked about in verse 23 was his way being hid and hedged in. And even that at times, unless we lean on God in the right way, can give us a sense of meaningless because we don't know what's going on and we can't do anything about it. And we just wish then, let me get out of this by dying. When your worst nightmare happens, when things just keep coming and coming and coming upon you, no doubt the desire for death reveals the enormity of grief. And our passage tells us that even godly believers can wish for death. That is possible that the grief could be that bad. We know, we understand that there are times when people, maybe up in years, are struggling and their body is aging and all those different things here, and they just wish to go home. Are there times in which we as Christians, younger in years, still having much of our life, say, Lord, come in the rapture and take us. Take us. Is there much difference in some way of escape? I mean, wishing that God would allow us to die or be taken in the rapture? Either way, we're seeking to get out. Job desires this in a sense here. The concept of grief leading to the thoughts of death is hardly surprising to those of us today. And that word suicide comes increasingly to mind. In 2016, the CDC said that 45,000 people committed suicide. It's the 10th largest cause of death in the United States. They say that from 2000 to 2016, age-adjusted suicide increased 30% in the United States of America here. because there are many people that really do believe that death is the only way out of their suffering. But there's a major difference between Job and those considering suicide. Job never considered suicide. Job wished for death, but he never contemplated suicide. No doubt suicide was known in ancient times. In the Bible, it records ones like Samson, Saul, Saul's armor bearer, Ahithophel, Zimri, and Judas. Suicide was an option. It was something people did know about in ancient times. But it wasn't acceptable to Job because it would have signified that he had lost all hope in God whatsoever. Job is a godly man. He's a man of faith, and his faith is not going to allow him to commit suicide here. And there's a major difference in that. To have such incredible anguish and pain and grief that we could wish that we died is far different than suicide. But what incredible grief Job and others do feel when those thoughts come to their mind. There's a third truth that I want you to see here. Those grieving might ask why, out of pain more than curiosity. They might ask why out of pain more than curiosity. Job asked why multiple times. Look at him again, verse 11. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? Or why the breasts that I should suck? Verse number 16, he moves to the second segment, and in so doing, really a why is implied there. Why is a hidden and timely birth I had not been? That's implied there. Verse 20, wherefore means why. Why is light given to him that is in misery and life unto the bitter in soul? Why? He asked the question here. Someone noted that in the question, why are wrapped up all the questions of sufferers throughout the ages? Why is a very common question when people ask, when people suffer here. And when we look at this, we at first begin to think that maybe Job really wanted answers here. Job wants answers to his questions. He's asking why. Doesn't he anticipate an answer? But as we look at it and we study it here, we understand by the end of the story that God never gives Job an answer. God never explains to Job why. And in times of grief, as people ask that question, we would have to ask whether or not an answer, an intelligible answer, is even something that is going to fully provide the comfort in those horrible times of grief. You're sitting there with a loved one going through this unimaginable grief, and they ask that question, why? And you're sitting there and you're trying to come up with some thoughtful, considerate, helpful answer to try to answer that. Can you ever come up with an answer to the question that's going to take away their grief? Can you ever fully answer that why that's going to satisfy that and really give them the intellectual understanding that they need to answer that and to take care of that question? Or are there times even in which the question is that they're asking is a question more of grief than wanting an intellectual answer? When Jesus Christ is on the cross and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Did he not know? Was he looking for an intellectual answer? Or was he pouring out the pain and the anguish of what he was experiencing on the cross? You take a situation in which here is a couple in their 50s and they've been married for several decades. The man is diagnosed with cancer and in a few months here, the man passes away. They've been married for decades. It's now really been the vast majority of her life has been to be married to this person. And it's all that she knows. And he's been her best friend. And they've done everything together. The funeral comes. And at the funeral, there are hundreds that are gathered there. And the gospel is preached. And many people hear the gospel of Jesus Christ that maybe otherwise would never have known, would never have heard the gospel at that funeral. But there's going to be times in which that widow is going to continue to ask that question, why? And when she sits there in the evening and she's sitting there all alone in the winter and the wind is blowing and she just wishes that somebody else were sitting on the couch beside her here and she asks why? And when her car has a flat tire and she needs somebody else to help her change that flat tire and she asks why, somebody could say, you know what? The answer is that God allowed several hundred people to hear the gospel through the passing of your husband and through his funeral. Would it not be possible for her to say, I understand that and I'm a Christian and I thank God for that. But couldn't God have done it some other way? Couldn't God have allowed them to hear the gospel some other way? Why did he have to take my husband? Could it be possible that the question why, the best intellectual answers that we could possibly give her, may still not really take away the grief? Sometimes when we ask why, it's more of an expression of grief than necessarily being able to say that if you could give me the right answer, it'll take away all of the pain. Because it probably won't. The grief is still going to exist. The grief is still going to be there. For sake of time, let me mention the last three, and I need to wrap this up here. Number four is this: those grieving might feel out of control and stuck. And that's the way Job feels. He's hedged in, and he's stuck. And many times when we're grieving, we're stuck there, and there's nothing that we can do to get out of it. Number five: those grieving might feel restless and in turmoil. Feel restless and in turmoil. And Job is that way. If I just could die, I would be at rest. I'd be done with all of this stress, all of this frustration here. And number six, those grieving should not curse God. Job didn't curse God. Again, as I mentioned earlier, if Job had in this chapter cursed God, if what he was trying to do was really cursing God, then I would submit to you that the story would have ended right there and God would have lost the battle. Job isn't cursing God here. Job is tenaciously hanging on to his faith, and yet he is grieving and he is hurting and he is pouring out his grief, expressing the pain. And there are going to be times in which we as godly individuals are going to suffer, and we might express our grief in some just surprising ways. We need to understand these things. And we need to understand these things when our loved ones beside us are grieving in this ways so we can handle them properly. In recent years, railroads have become more aware of the challenges that those engineers and those conductors face when their trains are involved in a crash. They say to those conductors and engineers that it's not a matter of if you'll be involved in one. It's only a matter of when. It will happen. In fact, some railroad companies have gone so far as, in advance, they give counseling and training to do all that they can to prepare those engineers and conductors for the time in which they will grieve and they will suffer through no fault of their own. You know what? That is what God has done in Job chapter 3. He knows that there are going to be times in the future, if it hasn't happened already, in which you will suffer and in which you will grieve in incredible portions. And God says, let me help prepare you. I love you. I know pain myself. And let me give to you some things in Job chapter 3 to help you to grieve. This chapter gives us permission to grieve appropriately. There are myths that people have about grief. One myth is people with a strong faith don't grieve. That's a myth. Another myth is a strong person should be able to get through a loss without showing emotion. That's a myth. Another myth is, if you express intense feelings, you're losing control of yourself. Or the other myth, crying is a sign of weakness. Or another myth, it's better to deal with grief intellectually than emotionally. Job's grief gives us permission to grieve appropriately. And Job's grief helps us when we have situations where we're put next to somebody that's grieving and we don't know how to help and we don't know what to say. And we don't know how to interpret some of the things. And they ask us why. What's going on? How do we handle it? And so, because of the curse and sin in our world, we will suffer. But we serve a good God who gives us permission to grieve, who gives us instruction on grief, who helps us understand the grieving process. Job chapter 3 challenges us to have good grief.
Visit us at 11164 Hanson Boulevard or online at coonrapidsbaptist.org.